We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne, is at the controls. It would be natural to think of the international financial crisis that has now been affecting the world since 2007. Be natural to think of that as an economic problem and something that would require an economic solution. In this hour of Focus, we will consider the political dimensions of this crisis. We'll be talking with James Kwok. He is the co-author of a recently published book that has been getting a lot of attention. The title of the book is 13 Bankers, The Wall Street Takeover and the Next Financial Meltdown. Pantheon is the publisher in the book. And in this book, he and his co-author, Simon Johnson, who's professor of entrepreneurship at MIT's Sloan School of Management, they make the argument that, in fact, America's biggest banks and the people who run them have accumulated a lot of political power, and they have used that power to their advantage. And that is one reason why they continue to thrive while a lot of other people struggle. That will be the subject of our conversation this morning. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest, James Kwok. He co-founded, along with Simon Johnson, the blog BaselineScenario.com, where they have done a lot of commentary and reporting on the global financial crisis. He was also the co-founder and vice president of marketing at Guidewire Software Incorporated. He has a PhD in history from University of California, Berkeley, and is now pursuing a law degree at Yale Law School. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Questions are welcome. As always, we do ask people, if they can, to be as brief as they can in their comments. That way we can get in as many different people as possible. But your questions, comments are certainly are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And you may also email your comments to will-talk@illinois.edu. And, of course, any point here, your questions are certainly welcome. Dr. Kwok, hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks very much for being with us. I guess maybe the place to begin is to make the point, as you do in the book, that not only is the financial sector a very big part of the American economy, but a very small number of very large institutions make up a very big chunk of the American economy.
Yeah, this is true. I mean, we actually have about 8,000 banks, I believe, is the total count in the United States, but the vast majority of them are very tiny. And at the top of the system, we have six very large banks that together have assets equal to about over 60% of the American economy. And by contrast, in the 1990s, that figure was down around 16 or 17%. So I think everyone knows just by looking at, you know, the signs on the banks in their hometown, everyone knows that there's been a huge amount of consolidation in the retail banking industry. And the same has been true in the investment banking industry. So we've really, In a modern economy, I think we all understand that finance is crucial to the economy and the financial system is crucial to economic prosperity. And effectively, we've placed a lot of our economy in the hands of a very small number of banks.
Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the things too that you note is that when the crisis first happened, of course, the question that everybody asked was, well, how did this happen? And I think to some extent people are still asking that question.
Yeah.
More recently, I think also in addition to that question, people are looking at what happened and they're looking at the fact that while a lot of people got hurt, these big institutions seem to be doing just fine. So in addition to the how did this happen question, then people have laid on top of that the why has nothing changed question.
Yes.
Your answer in both cases is it's all about politics.
Yeah, that's correct. And I think this has been somewhat controversial when we first started writing about this in this country, because I think in the United States, we like to believe that our economy is run by some abstract, idealized free market principles. We've believed that for maybe 20 or 30 years now. But I think, as you said, there are two key questions. How did this happen? And why has nothing changed? And we think the answers to both are politics. So to take the first question, there was a period when, or still today, you know, if you read an account of the financial crisis, the dominant narrative you get is very technical. So most accounts tell you about, they tell you what a subprime mortgage is, and then they tell you what a mortgage-backed security is. They tell you what a collateralized debt obligation is. They tell you what a rating agency is. They tell you a little bit about how banks have assets and liabilities and how, you know, when the assets start falling in value, the banks start going bankrupt, and then they tell you a little bit about how that bleeds into the real economy and starts hurting real companies and real people. And I think that's all true. But it makes the financial crisis seem like it was, you know, a comedy of errors, a lot of mistakes made by lenders and rating agencies and banks and investors. And the point we want to make in the book is that, yes, that's true, but the underlying factor was that we had this highly deregulated financial system, and that this highly deregulated environment was engineered by banks who wanted that deregulated environment and either put in place politicians or officials who agreed with them or convinced the officials in Washington that this was the way to run a financial system. And then I think, you know, that's a debatable point. People can argue with us about that. But I think the question of what's happened in the last year and a half to 2 years is really strong evidence of our position. Because exactly, people are saying, okay, we had this crisis. It was largely caused by Wall Street banks. A couple of them failed, but they were absorbed by other Wall Street banks, which are now even larger than ever, more powerful than ever. And what happened here? And then still we have had no substantial reform yet. I mean, that could change in the next couple of weeks. We might get a reform bill, which I can talk about more later.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what we've seen over the past year and a half is that the financial sector has used an immense amount of lobbying and money and PR to try to beat back reform. And what we're really seeing now is that is the ability of the financial sector to defend itself when I think a year and a half ago any neutral observer would have predicted, you know, we should have seen enormous change in Wall Street by now, and in fact we haven't.
Yeah. Well, and I think that one of the things that you do with the book is try to take some a little bit longer view and look back in American history and talk about both the ways that people who were the titans of finance of their time tried to translate their economic muscle into political influence that would then feed back into their economic situation, and that from time to time various administrations and people in Washington have taken them on. But it seems that in more recent years, and this is something that's been really bipartisan, there has been much more of a hands-off kind of approach taken to this sector of the economy, and particularly this handful of very big institutions.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that, you know, over the course of American history, you know, we start off by talking about this Hamilton-Jefferson debate, which is, you know, a very useful way to start a book about the United States. And I think that over the course of American history, we have generally leaned towards Hamilton, and by that I mean favoring centralized institutions in order to promote economic development and economic prosperity. And I'm not saying that's been a bad thing. I think that, you know, you have to have a little bit of both. But we have gone back and forth. When it comes to the financial system, the previous chapter in the story was the Great Depression and the reforms of the 1930s that were pushed through by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And just as an aside, pushed through essentially with no consultation or very little consultation of the financial industry at all. I mean, Roosevelt really froze them out and treated them as the enemy. And so those reforms of the 1930s set in place a period of about 50 years of, you know, the most stable 50 years in the history of the American financial system. And we had moderately large banks, which were relatively restricted in their operations, and we had no lack of capital flowing to American business, and for most of this period we had an economic boom. I'm not saying the economic boom was because of constraints on the financial system, but I'm just saying that the constraints on the financial system were not inconsistent with economic growth. And then over the past 30 to 40 years, we have seen the pendulum just swing back all the other direction, all the way, perhaps further than ever before. And we've had this ideology, as you say, which has had very strong bipartisan appeal. This ideology that free, unrestricted financial markets are always good because they always promote economic growth, and that therefore, as Lee's, first of all, we should relax a lot of the constraints set up in the 1930s, and then perhaps even more importantly, as the financial system has become more and more innovative, the conventional wisdom in Washington has been that these innovations do not need to be policed. So Alan Greenspan is, you know, probably the leading exponent of this view in Washington over the past two decades, and he said even that he believed that in free markets you didn't even need to, the government didn't need to police against fraud, because markets would naturally correct for fraud because of people's reputation in the marketplace. So that's a particularly extreme view. I don't think a lot of I don't think, for example, Robert Rubin believes that. But that type of view is what led to the government's very strong hands-off policy when it came to things like derivatives and predatory lending, which we now know were some of the key ingredients of the financial crisis.
Our guest in this hour of focus is James Kwok. He is the co-author, along with Simon Johnson, of the new book, 13 Bankers. The subtitle is The Wall Street Takeover and the Next Financial Meltdown. Pantheon is the publisher. It's just out recently. Questions are welcome. We have somebody we'll get right to. Let me just give you the numbers again. In Champaign-Urbana, here where we are, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller in Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Say one thing rather quickly. It's sort of surprising to me that so many people all of a sudden are writing books about this. This is almost like they had their metrics ready to go and just waiting for something to happen. Unfortunately, the news people are not really doing too much helping us, I'm afraid. I did get to hear how this subderivative thing started, having to do with farmers betting on whether or not their crop would be good in the future. And somewhere from there, a lot of people who went to Yale and Harvard and stuff decided to twist and turn it in this way.
Yeah.
Recently, they've had them in Washington in front of Mr. Levin, who's certainly not an unintelligent man, and he was waving emails around, and yeah. They were pretty bad emails. Yet, I'm presuming lawyers have told these people to say no to everything, no matter how silly it may sound to the public. Especially, you know, we caught you in the cookie jar, fella. What the hell are you talking about? I was wondering if you could give some analysis of what the strategy would be of these people, even though there are essentially email facts all over the place, guys assuming identities because they're doing so well, you know, in the market. I think it was Fabulous Fab was one fellow.
Yeah.
And rather remarking about the stupidity of the people they're dealing with. I just wonder what the strategy would be by the lawyers, and then in return, if you could, what the strategy would be from the government or whoever goes after these people. My understanding is there's some countries in Europe are setting up some legal operations already to go after the. They bought some of this stuff under the provision that it was good. They didn't know that they were buying stuff that the company would turn around a bit, you know, short on the whole thing.
Yeah.
And it just seems. We've arrived at something. I don't know what to call it. Don't know that much about the economic history of the country in science, and it just bewilders me at times how these things were pulled off. Thanks a lot.
And just maybe what the caller is referring to, for those people who aren't sure, is just yesterday in Washington, in the Senate, some of the representatives of one of these very large institutions, Goldman Sachs, were there before testifying before the Senate, and particularly at issue, I think, were some financial instruments that Goldman Sachs constructed and sold, and with the knowledge that they were bad, and what they did internally was that they they bet against themselves in a sense. They placed a bet that their own instrument was going to fail. And questions were raised about, what does that have to do with representing the interest of your customers in good faith if you sell them something you know is bad and then you make it so that you can actually make money when it collapses? There are lots of questions here about this particular firm and others. I don't know whether Goldman Sachs is actually any worse than anybody else.
Yeah, good question.
For people who are really just their minds are boggled, and mine certainly is when I try to make my way through stories about this, what happened? How can we explain this in a way that's going to make sense?
Well, that's, I mean, that's a tough question. I don't know how much time I have here. So let me, there's a lot of very good issues raised there. So derivatives did start with farmers, and they started for a very valid purpose, which is that when you plant your crops in the spring, and I'm not a farmer, so excuse me if I make any mistakes here, when you plant your crops in the spring, you don't know what price they're going to sell at in the fall. And you don't want to take the risk that by the fall, you won't be able to sell your crops. So a very simple derivative is a futures contract where in April, you agree with somebody to sell, you know, 1,000 bushels of wheat at a preset price in October. And, you know, these things have been around for a very long time. They're traded on exchanges. They're very transparent. They had nothing to do with the financial crisis. Most people would say they're good for the economy. This, on top of this kind of simple derivative, we have erected a superstructure of increasingly complicated derivatives. And what's difficult, so I am, as a, you know, I am, some people expect me to criticize all kinds of derivatives and all kinds of financial innovation. What I would say is that as these derivatives become more complicated, they do have some benefits, but essentially the benefits get smaller and smaller and the costs get bigger and bigger. And I don't think society or the government has done a good job of weighing the cost and the benefits. So just to give I'm going to try to avoid all the details, but the transaction that Goldman is being sued by the Securities and Exchange Commission over is something called a synthetic collateralized debt obligation, or synthetic CDO. And this is really a there are these three levels of complication here. So a CDO, to begin with, is a new company, a new legal entity that buys one set of bonds and issues another set of bonds. And some people think, and you can make an argument, this is actually good for the economy because it brings more money into the market. It makes more capital available for people to invest. Then, but the transaction in question here was not actually a CDO like that. It's what's called a synthetic CDO, where there's no new money coming into the market. Essentially, you can think of it just as a side bet. So it's a side bet between one set of investors and Goldman that some other set of bonds is going to go up or down in value. And then the amazing thing is that the specific transaction that Goldman was dealing with was not even a synthetic CDO. It was kind of like a synthetic CDO in the sense that basically what they did is they took, you know, this is all done on paper. They said, okay, imagine that we created a synthetic CDO, and then imagine that we placed side bets on that synthetic CDO. And that's really what was being traded in this Abacus transaction. So at that point, what happens is that the argument that this has any benefit to the economy is extremely weak at this point because, again, there's no new money coming into any market. There's no price transparency because this is all being done, you know, essentially in secret. It's all confidential. And the risks created are very large because, I mean, besides, there are two sets of bad things happening. One is the opportunity for banks to make money at the expense of their clients, which you talked about. And the other bad thing that's happening is that you're creating lots of potential financial exposures that are hidden from view. And what happened in 2008 is that many exposures of this type that had been hidden from view suddenly exploded. You know, people didn't realize that AIG could lose hundreds of billions of dollars on its derivatives, and that's why AIG failed. So what we've had this environment in which, based on a very simple principle, a very basic principle that, you know, free markets are good, we have created these fantastical structures which serve very little economic purpose but have these negative side effects. Now, as to the question of the lawyers, the SEC Goldman suit is it's very interesting. And what's interesting about it to me is this. The SEC has a decent case, but it's not an open and shut case. Because what they're going after Goldman for is they're going after Goldman for failing to tell investors in this synthetic CDO, failing to tell investors that this whole transaction had been cooked up at the request of John Paulson, a hedge fund manager, who wanted the investments to fail. Okay, so the SEC is not suing Goldman for selling investments that collapsed. They're just suing them for failing to disclose this fact to investors. And the interesting point for me is not whether or not the SEC is going to win, although obviously I'm very interested in that. The interesting point is that this is all the SEC can actually sue them for, because our securities laws have gotten so lax that the basic principle is anything goes as long as, you know, you include it in the fine print.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is the more fundamental problem. So I've said on various occasions, I think very few people are going to jail as a result of this financial crisis, because I'm sure there was some fraud and some illegal activity at the margins, but for most of what happened, for the bubble and the bust and the financial collapse, there was no criminal activity needed to make that happen. And that, I think, is, you know, that's one of the central issues I think we have to face. And just as an aside, I think I think not a lot is being done to change that when it comes to financial reform.
See, that it seems to me that that's a really, really important point, just to underscore that, as well. While indeed there may have been fraud and corruption, probably not very much, but maybe some, the larger point is that these people didn't have to do anything illegal because the politicians essentially just let them do what they wanted to.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's our point. We kind of make that point in a point like that comes up in two different ways. I mean, one is exactly what you just said, which is that for the most part, if you're doing business with a Wall Street investment bank, it's buyer beware. You should assume that they are out to screw you, and in many cases they are. And that's why, you know, these emails that Carl Levin has been releasing, they look really bad. They make Goldman people look like really bad people. But I don't think you can send people to jail over those emails. I mean, in very specific cases, well, you won't be able to send them to jail. In very specific cases, you might be able to get civil liability, and you might be able to get fines if someone is very specifically saying, you know, I think that this investment is going to collapse, and on the same day, you know, he is telling an investor that I think this investment is good. You might be able to get people at the edges. But in general, this idea that, you know, you see emails saying, you know, we have too much exposure to the housing market, we want to unload it onto our clients, that's perfectly legal. And the other thing, just as an aside, the other point we make in the book and that we say is that, you know, another type of corruption you can think of is business people or banks buying politicians. And again, we think a lot of that didn't happen. I mean, in the Jack Abramoff sense of, you know, completely illegal exchanges of cash for political favors, we don't think that happened because the key mechanism over the past 20 or 30 years we think was actually ideological and then the revolving door. So I think there came to be a confluence of interests and identities between the people in Wall Street and Washington. And I think that the politicians in Washington, for the most part, didn't understand the modern financial system. And when the young, you know, smart, well-dressed lobbyists and lawyers from Wall Street came to talk to them, they were convinced.
Yeah, they accepted the basic ideology, the basic ideas of the market always works,
yes.
The market always regulates itself. You know, what's good for what's good for a financial industry is good for America. And that was sort of helped along by, you say, as the fact that we have a lot of people who've moved back and forth between the financial industry and the government.
Yes, exactly.
So that gives them an opportunity when they're in government to represent the interests of the financial industry and then to turn around and go back into the industry to take advantage of the fact that they were in government representing the industry's interests.
Yeah, and as I said, I think most of these people were true believers, which means that they weren't necessarily doing anything even unethical individually. And I think, you know, one of the things we talk about in the book, which I think is very important, is that, as you said earlier, this was a bipartisan phenomenon because you know, historically, to simplify things greatly, you know, the Republicans were the party of business and free markets, and the Democrats were the party of unions and workers and, you know, jobs. And in the 1990s, the Democrats became the other party of business and free markets. And in many ways, it was very good for the Democratic Party, you know, because the party under Clinton and Robert Rubin acquired a very business-friendly, responsible, fiscally responsible reputation. I think, you know, most people who have followed the last 20 years consider the Democrats to be better stewards of the public's money than the Republicans. And it's also enabled them to do two things. One, it enabled them to raise a huge amount of money from Wall Street. So I think, you know, in 2008, Obama outraised McCain in virtually every sector, including the financial sector. And then secondly, you know, it enabled Democratic congressmen to think, I can be a Democrat and I can be a servant of the working man, and I can still take money from Wall Street because what's good for Wall Street is good for America.
Yeah, and just early on here, just as one sort of illustration of the bipartisan nature of this deregulatory spirit, and it goes to the title of the book. Back in the late '90s, there was at one point where the head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, a woman named Brooks Liborn, really wanted to do something to get some regulation on derivatives, and the people at Treasury said, no, you can't do that. And in fact, someone called her and said, look, I've got these 13 bankers here in my office who say, if you do this, you will cause the worst financial crisis in this country since World War II.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this is I think this is a pretty damning indictment of the system. Then I'm going to give, if you allow me, I'll soften it slightly. I mean, we focused on that anecdote, not because we think if Brooks Liborn had succeeded, necessarily the financial crisis would have been prevented. Maybe it would have, maybe it wouldn't. By that point, arguably, it was too late. I mean, the opportunity to regulate derivatives was in 1994, which was the year when many large companies and Orange County lost huge amounts of money because of the derivatives trades that their banks had sold them. But we think that it's a damning anecdote, because what you have there is you have a senior government official not arguing with Brooks Liborn and saying, look, for these reasons, your idea is bad, you know, for these valid reasons of public policy. You have someone saying, my argument, you know, the proof that your idea is bad is that the bankers are telling it to me. And that's kind of a very damning indictment of the way things worked, that in Washington, people assumed that when it came to matters of financial regulation, the people in Wall Street were right. So the one caveat I want to give is that the argument you'll hear from, there was a little spat about 1 or 2 weeks ago about Robert Rubin and his question of did he favor regulation of derivatives or not. And the Rubin line seems to be that Rubin is claiming that he did favor regulating derivatives, just not the way Brooks Liborn wanted to, which may be true. But I think the question for Robert Rubin then, which he hasn't answered, is, you were Secretary of the Treasury, why didn't you do anything about it? So the only thing he did as Secretary of Treasury was to suppress Brooks Liborn's attempt. So yeah. I'm not convinced by his defense.
And this way, just to round this out, the person who was on the phone delivering this message about the 13 bankers, this was Larry Summers,
yes.
Who this is the same Larry Summers who is now the director of the White House Council on Economic Advisers.
Yes. Well, National Economic Council.
Or National Economic Council.
Yes.
In any rate, someone who is a top economic advisor to the president.
Yeah.
We have a number of callers. People have been patient. We'll get right back to the phone, starting with line number one. Hello.
Yes, hi. Very interesting. I think this probably goes back to the fact that, the real wages of the American male have been pretty much adjusted for inflation has been pretty much a straight line,
yep.
No increase since 1970. And the increase in wealth has been, for the American family, has been through the woman going to work. And that's falling apart now.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. It raises, there are two important connections. I think one, which has been noted by other people, is that for the past 15 years, we have substituted growth in assets, first technology stocks and then houses, for growth in wages. So we've sustained this consumption not by giving people better jobs, but by making people think that their assets were more valuable and encouraging them to borrow money against those assets, which I think was ultimately catastrophic. The other interesting point it raises is I think that, and this is a kind of point that doesn't, you know, is not in the center of discussion, but the hegemony of the free market ideology in the past 30 years has many forms, not just this financial deregulation. Another sign of that hegemony is this idea that we should measure economic goodness by our gross domestic product, so the total output of all the stuff we create. So this is the, you know, every quarter there's a number saying the economy grew or it shrank by X percentage points in the past quarter. And we have allowed that metric, because that is the dominant metric that the media and the politicians look at. They do not look at what's happening to, as you say, to income inequality and what's happening to the median worker in this country. Because we have seen, you know, by historical standards, we've seen moderately high economic growth over the past 15 years. I think a lot of that was illusory because a lot of it was, you know, construction and building subdivisions in the Nevada desert. We've had moderately high economic growth, and we've had kind of middling or worse economic prospects for the average American worker. And I think that's the product of a short-sightedness in our establishment about how we measure the performance of our economy that I would like to see change.
Right. Our guest this morning, James Kwok, he is the co-author, along with Simon Johnson, who is professor of entrepreneurship at the Sloan School of Management at MIT. They're the co-authors of the book 13 Bankers, The Wall Street Takeover and the Next Financial Meltdown, published by Pantheon. James Kwok also co-founded with Simon Johnson the blog BaselineScenario.com. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. To you. Next, we'll talk with someone in Urbana. Line number two. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? When long-term capital management collapsed in 1998, it was sort of a precursor to this where people became aware, maybe not the general population, but smaller groups, of these derivative contracts and how they were systemic in the financial system.
Yes.
And also, I've always thought of economics as more of a psychological phenomenon, not a science, like it's treated, and the mathematization of it.
Yes.
So you have Adam Smith. If you read his Wealth of Nations, if you actually read the book, you realize where he has all these codicils about, well, this and this, but, you know, the assumption about behavior of individuals being cumulative and for the betterment, but also he has a codicil that says, well, you need some sort of regulation.
Yeah.
Everybody throws out that part and just goes,
I know.
Oh, the hell with it. Free markets, everything. Which, of course, is so, and you're absolutely correct about the politicization of this stuff. And LTCM has collapsed. It was real interesting because I think some of the people now at the Fed in the East Coast, the Northeast Fed, were involved in saving these guys, these two Nobel
right.
people. And if I remember correctly, there's a lawsuit now going through the courts. They want their bonuses back. Do you know anything about that?
About the lawsuit? No, I don't.
Yeah. I read something in the New York Times about a year ago that they were suing those two Nobel laureates who said, we're not going to sign off until you give us our $30 million bucks each or something.
Wow. Okay.
And want their money back. But what do we do about this? I mean, other than, I mean, we acknowledge these things. And I mean, well, let me say your average person doesn't. But, I mean, how can we, Congress now is going to do this sort of show, I think, you know, dance around, oh, you guys are bad and we're not. They're all equally bad. Thank you very much.
Uh-huh. Sure. I mean, I think that the LTCM point is interesting. I think the lesson we learned from LTCM, unfortunately, was that if there's a financial crisis, the Fed will bail, you know, the Fed will be able to bail the system out. In that case, the Fed strong-armed a lot of banks into bailing out LTCM. So I think the lesson was, yes, we have a more dangerous system, but at the same time, we can isolate the problems and protect the real economy. And then I think the point about the psychology and economics is an interesting one. I mean, there's been a, you know, in the actual economics profession, the big trend, the big fad of the past 10 years has been behavioral economics and this idea that there are many, many situations in which people don't behave rationally and hence, you know, all of the theorems built on the assumption of rational behavior kind of fall apart. But that has certainly not made it into the Washington conventional wisdom, although the Obama administration does have a couple of behavioral economists on staff now. As to what we do, I mean, that's a tough question. I think that, you know, I think we're going to get a reform bill in the next few weeks. I think it's going to be significantly better than nothing. It's going to, as some people have said, it's going to improve the way that Washington regulates the financial system. It's not going to change the financial system itself very much. In the longer term, I think we need, and this may sound hopelessly optimistic, but I think we need a shift in public opinion similar to, say, what happened with Teddy Roosevelt at the beginning of the 20th century. So Teddy Roosevelt, when he began trying to break up the trusts, it was seen as a bit as tilting at windmills. So the modern understanding of antitrust, that monopolies are bad for the economy, didn't really exist. And Roosevelt first sued Northern Securities, and he won, and this led to the breakup several years later of Standard Oil. And over that period, people came to understand that monopolies are bad. And these days, very few people would say we should reconstitute Standard Oil or we should reconstitute AT&T. And I think that, you know, ultimately we'll need a similar shift in the conventional wisdom, because today the politicians in Washington are the people who have were elected and grown up over the past 20 years, and they're not going to change their minds immediately. And I think that, you know, I think that our political system in Washington imperfectly and slowly follows the public's attitudes. So we're going to have to see if two things happen. I mean, one is you need leadership from a politician, and Obama has not really shown that so far, in my opinion. And then secondly, you need people to care. And there are a lot of, in today's society, there are a lot of different interest groups, a lot of different movements trying to gain the attention of the electorate. And you know, my hope is that this becomes an issue that people care about and that leading politicians will champion. And then we'll see change.
All right. On to another caller, Champaign County, line 3. Hello.
Hi. In the beginning, you mentioned predatory lending, and there's a strain of this irredentist sort of laissez-faire people who are still stuck with this idea that it's just the pressure to lend to poor people that was done at Freddie Mac that's caused all of this.
Yeah.
And it's just so absurd. I mean, there are statistics that show, and I think I heard it from Simon Johnson, actually, that something like at least 60% of the collapse is no relation to this at all. It's all this superstructure of derivatives, et cetera, et cetera. It just seems to me that I do worry that there's a lot of show going on in the Congress, though. Grassley of Iowa actually voted in favor of this Arkansas senator's thing. But I understand that they probably people know that that's not really going anywhere anyway, because there's so much opposition in the full Senate. So he gets to go back to his constituency and say, I did what I could.
Yep.
But a broader thing, Phil Graham was the senator that had his name on the thing that they pushed through and that allowed the naked shorts and all this stuff going on without any oversight. But he's also on the chair of UBS.
And yes, that's right.
It seems to me that there's a bigger scandal that's getting very little less press, which is that the whistleblower, the Swiss guy who gave evidence to all of the tax evasion that was going on, that he's the guy that's in jail. And now we're talking about none of these bankers going to jail, but when the whistleblower goes to jail, I mean, there's obviously a lot of non-incentives for these people to not point out malfeasance if they ever want to get a job inside of this apparatus again. But when you put the guy in jail who actually probably did more to cut – anyway, I'm fulminating. I would like for you to address some of that, if you would. I know that
that's a very good point. I mean, the banks are doing the best they can to suppress whistleblowers, for example. So this is not going to land people in jail. Well, let me strike that. The banks are, for example, are sending out, you know, establishing policies very clearly internally saying, you know, you are not allowed to comment on anything relating to financial reform. You're basically not allowed to comment on anything relating to our business, to the media, on blogs and blog comments, using your name or anonymously, because they want to put as much pressure on people to toe the line. And you know, there have been some people from within the industry, certainly former bankers, some current bankers, some anonymous, mainly anonymous, talking about the problems and the excesses of the industry. But I think that the banks are doing their best to try to suppress that kind of dissent from within the ranks. And then secondly, as you say, I think, you know, what you say, I think, points to, it's another example of what I meant earlier about how the existing legal system doesn't create the right incentives. So exactly as you say, I mean, people who do things that seem corrupt get off scot-free because what they're doing is certainly within the confines of the law. And then the banks and their allies in the government have legal weapons that they can use against people who are enemies of the banks. So, I mean, I don't want to go too far and make it seem like, you know, we have a police state where people on Wall Street are calling the shots and so on. But certainly, we have a legal system right now that penalizes the wrong things and doesn't penalize the right things. And that's, again, it's something that I don't foresee changing anytime soon.
All right, another caller here. Terre Haute is next, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Yes, sir.
Yes.
Hi.
I guess I'm going to disagree a little bit with your last caller, because this collapse would not have happened had people paid their mortgages. Isn't that right?
Yes. I mean, I'd like to continue, but I'll
and the question is they've made mortgages with very low down payments, with maybe interest only, and the Congress encouraged this through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and yet they don't seem to be taking any responsibility for this collapse. I don't think it's all Wall Street, because Wall Street wasn't making these loans. They were just buying them later. The local banks were making the loans, and the government was encouraging it. Is that not – am I misunderstanding something?
Well, I think what you say is partly true, and I mean, partly I disagree with it. So, for example –
What part do you disagree with?
Well, for example, when you say that Wall Street wasn't making these loans, I mean, that's technically true.
Well, it is true.
Well, so, okay, so let me put it this way. So a lot of the mortgage lenders were not banks, right? They were non-bank mortgage lenders. And to make a loan, they have to get money from somewhere. And they got it in two ways. One is they got debt financing from Wall Street banks. So the Wall Street banks basically lent them money so that they could make these loans. The second way they got money is that after they made the loans, they were able to sell them to Wall Street banks. So the Wall Street banks were telling them, I will accept, you know, loans that have these characteristics because I need them to make securities. So I mean, yes, the people making the loans were the mortgage lenders. There was no way they could have been in operation without the backing from Wall Street. In addition,
wasn't also Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac encouraging this? The government.
Well, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were involved a little bit. So let me try to address that simply. So Fannie and Freddie were actually not allowed to make these subprime loans because the thing is that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So first I'll make the argument defending them, and then I'll tell you what I think was bad about them. So to defend Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they were not allowed to make these subprime loans because Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are only allowed to make what are called conforming mortgages, which have to meet certain criteria which are set by Congress. And those criteria are more demanding than the ones being used by most of the subprime lenders. So they just weren't able to get into that market. Now, what I do think was there are two things that were bad about Fannie and Freddie. One is that they were under pressure from Congress to promote home ownership by low-income people, and one way they did that is they did buy some mortgage-backed securities that were made out of subprime loans. So again, they weren't allowed to make the loans directly, but remember, these loans were being made by other banks. They were then being packaged up by investment banks and sold as securities. And Fannie and Freddie did buy a lot of those securities, so they did contribute. They did supply some of the money that went into subprime lending.
But our problem now is not all subprime loans, obviously.
That's true. That's true. In general, in the past decade, I think there are lots of problems with those companies. But in general, they were behind the trend when it came to, you know, innovating in subprime loans. When it came to creating these mortgage-backed securities, when it came to buying them, they wanted to get into these markets, and they tried because they were, you know, they were these weird thing, like implicitly government-backed private corporations. So they wanted to get in because they wanted to be part of the boom like everybody else. But for the most part, they were kind of slower, and they were restrained by certain congressional restrictions that the other banks didn't face. The big problem, you know, the other big problem with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is they were too big to fail, right? They had huge balance sheets. They had very little capital. They were able to get away with that because everyone knew that if they were to hit a crisis, the government would bail them out. And as a result, they were able to borrow money more cheaply. And that was a big problem. And I think, you know, I'll concede one thing. The current bill in the Senate doesn't address Fannie and Freddie at all. They just say we're going to deal with that later. And I think that, you know, that's a problem that for the past almost 2 years has been, you know, has been an obvious problem that has to be dealt with.
I need to jump in here. I want to thank the caller, and I hope we can get some more. But just in the time left, and we only have about 5 minutes, I do want to hit on the too big to fail notion, because that, I think, is also a central point that you've made, that we got to the point where we had these enormous institutions that we could not allow to fail, and so the government had to intervene to avoid a national, if not an international, collapse.
Yep.
You're saying, you know, here there's a problem that these institutions shouldn't have been allowed to grow that to that size. And what you would do is that you would want to say to them, maybe not say how that they should do it, but that in fact that they need to be broken up.
Yes, that's exactly right. I think that one of the, you know, there are many problems that led to the financial crisis. Some of them we're going to solve. We're not going to have another bubble based on subprime lending for the next 10 or 20 years just because, you know, people's memories are that long. But the more fundamental characteristic of the system is that you have institutions that are allowed to do more or less whatever they want, allowed to get as big as they want to be. And when you have that degree of concentration, when they hit a crisis, they have to be rescued somehow by the government in order to protect the financial system and the real economy. And we think that allowing these companies to be so big gives them unfair competitive advantages and also creates the expectation that they'll be bailed out. So we think the simplest solution to that is just not to have institutions that are that big or that systemically important in the first place. I would say that the Dodd bill does a pretty good job of giving the government useful powers to deal with these too-big-to-fail banks in a crisis, but it doesn't do enough to avoid the problem of their existence in the first place.
Other callers here. Let's next go to Charleston, line one. Hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I haven't heard you talk about it yet, but I was wondering if this also called into question the role and the power of the Federal Reserve. Because I think, as I understand, it's a non-government organization. And historically, Greenspan, kind of the champion profit guru of the deregulation or self-regulation. And what was interesting is, even though he's gone, and I think publicly said, almost apologized for his ideology and said that he was wrong.
Yep.
The Federal Reserve still keeps this as like their mantra. Disconnect, and shouldn't we worry about the role, the power, and who ultimately runs the Federal Reserve, especially when they can have that kind of autocratic control even over our Congress. So I think he was part of the suppressive team that silenced or helped silence the figure name you mentioned earlier.
Buxley-Born, yes.
Yeah.
So if you could talk about that, I haven't heard you talk about it, but I'd be very interested to read your book, and I thank you very much.
Right,
sure.
Thank you.
Yeah, on the Fed, I mean, there are a bunch of complicated issues. Greenspan did essentially apologize. He's been backing off that. Recently he said he was right 70% of the time, and he says that was pretty good. But just as an aside, the Fed does a lot of things. The Fed was certainly implicated in this crisis for two reasons. One is a lot of people talk about they kept interest rates too low early in the 2000s, helping to create the housing bubble. That, I think, is – well, I'll just move on. The other thing is that the Federal Reserve, under Greenspan, was in charge of enforcing consumer protection statutes. So they were the agency that could have scaled back on some of the predatory lending, and they basically did not do that because, as you said, Greenspan was a champion of free markets. So I think that the Fed has done a kind of a lousy job. But I think the most structurally – so. I think it's a very, very interesting point you raised. So the Fed is a hybrid organization. There are 12 Federal Reserve banks, which are actually not part of the government, and they are controlled indirectly by the private banking system. There's also a Federal Reserve Board of Governors, which is all appointed by the president, that is part of the government. And key Federal Reserve policy is set kind of by the two of them put together. But you're absolutely right that it's become an autocracy. And in the Bernanke reconfirmation hearings, one thing you would hear from supposedly respectable commentators is that, you know, if you don't reconfirm Bernanke, the markets are going to plunge. And this idea that our economy and our financial system are so dependent on one person, I really think is a bad thing. And I think that Ben Bernanke's a hardworking, good man, but, you know, he could have a heart attack. And the idea that for a while people were saying Greenspan was, you know, even more important than the president is also just frightening. So I do think that there should be changes in the Fed to make it more transparent. And frankly, to make it more democratic, I don't see those coming. I don't think those are in the bill. There is a movement in Congress called the Audit the Fed movement to open it up. I think that the administration is going to resist that, and I don't think it's going to succeed.
I'm trying to get one more caller here. Sure. Line two, Urbana. Hello.
Yes. Senator Hatch stated he's against the current proposed bill because it doesn't include Fannie or Freddie, and both institutions are into the government. The government has given them $124 billion, and it seems awfully curious to me that they are not in this bill.
Well, I mean, it seems a little curious to me as well. Like, I think that if you're going to have a comprehensive reform proposal for the financial system, Fannie and Freddie are an important part of that, and you should deal with it. I don't think if I were in Orrin Hatch's situation, I would not vote against the bill because of that, because I think it's a good bill, and I think that Fannie and Freddie can be dealt with separately, which is the Democrats' plan of record. If I were a Republican, I think it might be reasonable for him to demand that the Democrats at least state what their plan is for Fannie and Freddie, because I do think that something has to be done about it. And I would not be happy if the Democrats dodged that completely, but I think the bill as it stands is probably worth passing.
Well, we have just about a minute here. So what's your best prediction on what's likely to happen in terms of reform?
Well, I think this year we're going to get a relatively weak bill. And I say that I think we will get something because in the past few weeks there's been, you know, an increase in public anger towards Wall Street, and the SEC Goldman suit was part of that. But I think it's going to be a relatively weak bill because I think the Democrats are really going to want to hold on to all 59 senators, because if they can only hold on to, say, 52 senators, then the Republicans will vote against this thing, and they'll say it was a bipartisan rejection of, you know, of liberal socialist overreaching. So the Democrats will want to hold on to all 59 senators, and I think because there are a lot of moderate and conservative Democrats, that means a weak bill. I think, for example, one of your callers mentioned Blanche Lincoln's proposal to say that the banks have to spin off their derivative subsidiaries. I don't think that's going to make it. So I think we'll get a modest bill. I think it'll be better than nothing. I think the most unfortunate thing is that Washington will then declare victory and say we've solved this problem for all time, when we haven't.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, James Kwok, is the co-author, along with Simon Johnson, of the recent book 13 Bankers, The Wall Street Takeover and the Next Financial Meltdown. That's the subtitle. It's published by Pantheon. It's out now. Dr. Kwok, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thanks. It was a pleasure. I loved it.